We are just 1 month away from 229 and beyond, a weekend of science, stand-up, and stargazing in 29 Palms, California, happening June 7th and 8th at Outpost 29. And this Friday, May 10th, we are announcing some lineup additions that are going to knock your socks off. So I recommend you get your early bird passes now. You have until May 10th to get discounted passes for the whole weekend if you visit 229andbeyond.com. That's T-O-29andbeyond.com. If you get your early bird pass now, you'll also get a complimentary hand screen printed poster courtesy of the great Caitlin Gill and Merch Kitchen. And that's, of course, in addition to the pass that gets you into all the festivities, those that we've announced already, including Bobcat Goldthwait, Farah Alibay, Skywatcher, Guided Stargazing, Trivia, and Karaoke, and, of course, the lineup additions that will be coming on May 10th when the price goes up. So get those early bird passes now. Trust me, you will not regret it. On with the show.
Probably Science.
And welcome to Probably Science. I'm Andy Wood.
I'm Matt Kirshen. We are without Jesse right now because he's on tornado alert. So hope everything's all right down there in Tennessee. Any of our Tennessee listeners and Tennessee-based co-hosts of this podcast. But we do have a guest, a returning guest, fan favorite, friend of the show, Shane Moss. How are you, Shane?
I'm great. Well, before your recording, you did say he was being attacked by the wind. Was that what you... I didn't want listeners to miss out on that, because that is like...
That is true, yeah.
It's a more poetic...
He and his neighbors are being... Yeah, they are being currently assaulted by high-speed gusts. But...
Wow. Yeah, sending
our
best, hoping that
passes.
He's
I am.
Is that true?
Have you never done the show together?
I think like once, maybe. It's just, like every time you guys book me, something bad happens to him.
Oof.
Which I mean.
Well, maybe that jinx
correlation
is extending.
And causation, but.
But the correlation continues.
It might be me.
Of jinxing, because you've had a pretty bad day. I would count those among, if it were me, that would be my worst day of the year.
My van that I got broke into, my van that I live out of, I don't live in necessarily. It's actually pretty rare that I sleep in it, although it is suited for that. But I was staying at a friend's place last night, and I wish I would have been staying in it instead. Well, maybe that would have been more dangerous. But yeah, someone broke into my van, didn't break any windows, which is nice. They must have like used a Slim Jim or whatever, if that's what use to open car doors. And then in
the,
my back,
the meat snack?
They used the meat snack to they step into it. They were
used
always
a thin cylinder of processed beef, whatever. Or is it pork? I don't know what kind of meat they're made out of. Turkey?
It.
Who knows?
No one knows. And and they must have looked in the back. And I have just recently upgraded my merch organization game by getting these Milwaukee toolboxes that have like, you know, there's a base with wheels and then they all like click together and stack. And so all the merch goes in one easy carry. We can bring everything in
so they probably
really
thought they're getting like an expensive drill.
Yeah.
They're expecting like screwdrivers and wrenches and very resellable stuff, and instead they've got a Shane Moss beanie.
Yeah, there's like a bunch of like Shane Moss coloring books and stuff.
Oh my God.
Blotter paper. There is drugs. There's some drugs. They're legal. I have a brand of legal psychoactives that it actually launches on my birthday, May 25th, but I've been experimenting and selling them at shows. And so there was some of those in there too, but there was also those were in other places and they didn't take other, like I also had really interesting, drugs that are illegal most places, but I'm in California. So I'm like, I can drive around with these because I'm on a psychedelic tour right now. And so whenever I'm on a psychedelic something, I get handed lots of psychedelics afterwards, which I usually either don't accept or quickly just give to a wait staff or something like that as a tip and don't want to have in my possession.
We're basically looking for some... we're looking for some thieves who are just kind of particularly zen. They've stolen psychoactives and coloring books. Like, we're looking for really chill and in the moment, really mindful thieves.
And decorative blotter paper. Blotter paper with no LSD on it. Just 900 squares of paper.
That won't stop them selling it to schools.
My face on it.
You've got these psychoactive drugs on these.
Yeah, I mean, I wasn't even necessarily going to mention them. I mean, we can talk about them, but it's part of what was stolen. They're like mood altering. They're very nuanced. Blue Lotus and Amanita muscaria. They're like, they fall within the supplement laws and are also just like unregulated. They're plants from Blue Lotus is a. Egyptians used to mix it in wine, and then Amanita muscaria is this famous red and white mushroom that is horribly toxic if you eat it on its own, but Siberians figured out how to process it and then use it ceremonially, and because of a lot of weird reasons, it's not regulated, and it's also like not psilocybin or psilocin. It's not a psychedelic. You're not gonna meet God or like see fractals or anything like that. It's more like a chill kind of body buzz type of thing. I would call them more of like best user is like someone that wants like a cannabis alternative. Like cannabis is too intense for them, or they like have to worry about drug tests or something like that. And so anyway, this is they got a bunch of those as well, which is like has a very high retail value for me, and then probably a lot of value for them. It's probably going to make them like very unpopular in their community, as like people think that they're getting like you know, real escape mechanisms, and instead are just getting like a subtle mood alteration. But they will add a smile,
like taking a hero dose of chamomile tea.
Yeah, exactly.
So that name of that mushroom
dose of chamomile.
He's going for it. This psychonaut.
Whoa, easy, Tiger.
that name you said rang a bell, and I think I'd heard about that mushroom recently.
Yeah,
and sure enough, it is inspiration for the Mario mushroom, which I'm sure you know.
And some people say it's responsible for the origins of the Santa Claus story. The idea being that shamans, leaders of the community, would process these, and then come winter solstice, they would go around in sleighs pulled by reindeer to drop off these packages. And I guess sometimes doors would be snowed in, and so they'd have to drop them in through like a hatch in the roof or a chimney or whatever, as well as the story goes. And then the Europeans came, saw some of these traditions, brought them back, and through games of telephone and Macy's getting involved, we have Santa is the idea. I have no idea if that's true or not. I haven't really looked into it much, but it's a fun story.
Yeah.
I thought the origin of the Santa Claus story is that at Christmas time, Santa Claus brings you presents.
Actual Santa Claus brings you presents. Yeah, that's where it came from. The real guy that flies around and delivers.
Am I crazy here? Like, what are we?
How old were you guys when you first questioned Santa Claus, or did your parents present it as a real thing? They had to for a while, right?
Yeah, mine definitely did. Oh, Matt, I know you're Jewish. I don't know if you also had some Christmas.
No,
we did the
Santa thing, but I can't remember which of Santa Claus and the Tooth Fairy I twigged, but first, but I do remember a time where I'd lost a tooth and I was still awake, and my mum, there was no subtlety at this point. She just came into the room. I was like, I pretended to be asleep, but she like lifted the pillow up by half a foot, grabbed the tooth, put a coin in there, and then just like dropped the pillow down with my head. Like, I'm sure my memory of it 35 years later or whatever it was has exaggerated the thing, but I do remember it being like the least gentle, like, he's not gonna wake up, bang.
I think my grandparents used to like drug us or something, because I distinctly remember staying up to like catch Santa Claus so I'd finally have proof, and it was just like never possible. And I don't see how that's possible without drugging children, which I think was like okay back then.
Yeah, just like a little. Isn't that a thing also, like when kids are teething, sometimes like old parental hack would be like some kind of hard liquor on their gums or something?
Yeah, yeah.
It
was before tablets. That's what they would do. They would just drug children.
But I think I probably, sub age 10, figured out that something was amiss with the Santa stuff. I know there was some Christmas when I wished that he would give me a very specific thing that didn't exist yet that I realize now is a smartphone. Like, I just, like, I forgot if I just thought it or wrote it down, but I just wanted, like, a handheld color TV that would, I guess they had, like, Watchmen. So
you were just workshopping ideas for Santa?
But I was like, well, if he's like magic, he'll create this thing that doesn't exist. And then I either wrote this down or in my head, like, told him to like leave it in a specific.
So you asked for inventions, basically.
Area.
Yeah. Like, I'm gonna ask for something that is inaccessible to parents.
Yeah. And as a lover of television, a lifelong addict, I just wanted like a handheld color television.
Well, I mean, in the North Poles, like, you know, there's a lot of children, and there's like an assembly line situation and everything. I mean, I don't think like it works that way. I don't think you can just get like a specific thing that doesn't exist, or without like R&D or setting up the, I don't know. It turns out, you know, the more I talk about it, the more I realize how little I know about the North Pole and its going on.
I think it's like Chinese IP rules, where they can't really innovate, but they'll copy anyone else's tech, right? They'll just rip it off, but you're not going to expect like a really groundbreaking leap forward.
Yeah, yeah.
It's international waters.
That is weird that Santa Claus IP. is just making like G.I. Joes, which is like also what's that Toys R Us? That is,
yeah. Hasbro,
I guess,
or
I
Kenner?
Never really thought
yeah,
about
just
that.
Just daring Mattel to come and sue him. Like, come at me, Nintendo. What are you going to do? I'm in the North Pole.
It would be great if every Christmas version was just off.
I'm Santa, go fuck yourself.
But it's off by one letter. It's like the Simpsons Panaphonics Sorny.
Shane, tell us about your tour. What's your new tour that you're on?
Yeah, so this is it's called A Better Trip. So my first psychedelic tour was a good trip, and then I originally had a grand plan to do like this good trip, bad trip, and then better trip, exploring some of like issues that I had years ago with getting too arrogant with psychedelics, and having like a whole arc and everything. And then because of the complications of the show that I put together, it's basically similar to my old psychedelic show, but with visuals. I have a live VJ providing real time visuals, and so I'm also I'm like learning how to do that. It's kind of like a two person show, but I'm like interacting with a screen behind me in real time as well. So it's a lot of fun. I always wanted to figure out a way to, I always felt that an aspect of articulating the psychedelic experience is lost if there isn't a visual component. And so this is how we pulled it off. We collaborated with a bunch of different artists. And then my VJ, who's like this wizard, Michael Strauss is his name, of Strauss Visuals, has been, he's like one of the first video jockeys, like providing visuals for, you know, psychedelic bands and stuff like that. He's been doing it for 25 years. He was like programming computers at like 8 years old in the 80s and did his first like VJ set for his 21st birthday party, and has been like using AI and various, like, you know, these cutting edge tools that now have been made a little more user friendly and people are now becoming more familiar with. He's been working with for well over a decade and stuff. And so it's this really, I mean, we call it an immersive show for lack of a better word. It was originally made for like 4-wall projection mapping rooms, but those don't exist everywhere. So it's usually just the screen behind me at whatever theater or whatever I'm in. And it's super fun. It's probably the most fun tour I've ever been on, and it's been pretty successful so far as well.
That's actually part of why I hit you up, is because the ad that you successfully targeted me with on Instagram for the tour, I was like, holy shit, looks awesome, and I love Shane, and there's one coming to the desert I think in 3 weeks. So
it's amazing the things that I'll do to not make organic social posts. I have like a whole marketing person, and then like the two different like PR-ish people, and I have all like almost a full-time web designer and stuff like that, and like for this new site that we're about to launch, which is going to look a lot better than the current one and have cool functionality to it. But yeah, I at the end of the day, I'm like, oh yeah, maybe I should just post entertaining social videos and build a following like everyone else does. But instead, I use all of the marketing tools available and spend a bunch of money.
I mean, worth it.
And people find out about it and it works.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not sure I would have known otherwise. And I'm like, well, that's on May 28th. I'm going down to Palm Springs to see that.
Yeah. I'm looking forward to it. It's a fun way to meet, to reach a target demographic. Usually there's always like, you know, it's always hard to find exactly what the demographic is. It's also shifting quite a bit. This tour, the first psychedelic tour that I did, I think I first did the show in like 2014, 2015 was the first time I even attempted it. And then when I put together a tour, that ended in 2017, it was like, there was definitely a vibe of like, whoa, this is like very underground and edgy. And like, I can't believe someone's talking about psychedelics right now. And this was my tour ended, I think weeks before Michael Pollan's book, How to Change Your Mind, came out, and was like in the front of every bookstore, and like did just like, really shook up the world in terms of like normalizing psychedelics and people that were otherwise judgmental, or like psychedelic books being like hidden in the back of the bookstore, and you sound like you're asking for the porn section or something when you go in and ask for them. It was like front facing and a bestseller and everything, and so now this demographic is like, it's interesting. There's a ton of people that haven't even done psychedelics before. And when I say a ton, maybe between 10 to 20% of the audience. So it's not the majority, but that's way more than the first tour. And it seems like people are just like becoming increasingly curious, even if they were never the type before, to find themselves in the psychedelic space. And it's all sorts of stuff. It's like weird. There's like weird, like how like wellness and guru-y it's gotten over the since that time has been interesting too. It's changed quite a bit in just like the last 6 years, but it's a super fun tour.
Yeah. I'm curious what you think of that and the normalization of you know, the tech bro microdosing cliche, or like Elon getting blowback for talking about what's the tranquilizer, ketamine, which maybe doesn't even count as a psychedelic. But yeah, what's your take on the trending nature of this as a social signifier versus maybe an actual tool?
I mean, it's easier to not be ashamed of talking about psychedelics, for sure. It's there's less taboo than ever. There's a lot of people that wished they had gotten in on the green rush with marijuana that are now thinking psychedelics is going to be that for them. And in some ways, it's done well by me. It came from a genuine place, but it's also served as kind of a good hook and everything. And some people have benefited from it, but it's also, psychedelics don't have the same, weed's something people will do, every day. You're looking for a customer that's going to do something every day and come back into your store next week. And psychedelics are a once a year type thing for the average person. Yeah, and
that's,
so
that's why I've invested in glue. I'm big into the glue scene, and
oh yeah,
I'm selling them
all day every day.
Yeah, I sell them with the bag, so you don't even need to put them in the bag yourself. It's just ready to go.
Nice. Is it branded? That's what I've done. And can I white label your product?
See, I should have thought that through. I think that might have something to do with the two different things that we've been doing. Your mind's been expanded, and I'm just a little glued out right now.
Well, nitrous is definitely coming on the scene in a bigger way, and that's something that's known for being a bit addictive. And ketamine's actually becoming a little bit problematic. Ketamine's the only psychedelic, and I do consider it a psychedelic. I mean, it's a dissociative, but certainly anything where you can have an out-of-body experience and go right to another realm and everything else. I'm I don't know what your criteria is for a psychedelic, but that's a step below a DMT experience to me. The experience itself of a ketamine breakthrough experience, which is a regular old, you go into a ketamine clinic and they shoot you full of ketamine, and that's about where you're going to be, which is this would be, everyone used to call it the K-hole or whatever, but that's definitely a pretty wild experience. I would call it, it's much shorter, but I'd call it more intense than LSD or mushrooms. And so I don't, but people are always persnickety about what is MDMA. Is MDMA a psychedelic? And I don't know. It's a whole rabbit hole, I suppose. But ketamine's the one that does have some addictive qualities to it. And so then it's also the one that is profitable on the street. And so then it's causing problems too, because then the type of people that are out to make money are going to be wanting to sell more addictive things. And so then it used to be there'd be your coke dealer or whatever, and then there'd be your mushroom dealer, and those were two very different people. And your mushroom dealer was just trying to save the world and just right, selling it for whatever profit to get by, but basically trying to give the stuff away. And whereas the coke dealer's hoping you're going to call 4 hours later for more. And ketamine is somewhat being taken, street ketamine is somewhat being taken over by that crowd some. And then within that world, there's a lot of adulteration and of course, fentanyl being such a problem. Now there's more and more deaths happening at like Burning Man-ish type events. And it's mostly because of fentanyl-laced ketamine.
Which we've talked about this just from, I mean, it's sort of crass to talk about it this way, but, you know, in terms of an economics thing, just looking at the market of drugs, like it doesn't make a lot of sense to kill off your customers. Maybe the theory that this cross-contamination is mostly accidental holds, or maybe it's just that if something is going to be cut so that you can have a larger quantity of it, but you still want to make sure someone feels something, like any high is better than no high. Cause it seems like, yeah, if you're expecting a mushroom trip and you get an opiate one, like that's a drastically different experience and you might die. So it's like, what were the market forces that led these dealers to cut everything with fentanyl, you know, or what's your theory of that?
I don't know. I mean, the cross-contamination one's kind of interesting, I think, that just like they're working in the same, you know, measuring this stuff out with the same scales on the same table and stuff. And there's a little cross-contamination. I don't know. I mean, I guess fentanyl is maybe like dirt cheap or something like that. So adding a little something extra.
Per quantity. Yeah.
And so maybe it's that like, because I don't understand. Look, as someone who likes both ketamine and opiates, I would happily, have an Oxy or something like that if someone handed it to me and I knew what I was like actually doing and the amount that it was. But I don't know why you would want those two experiences necessarily at the same time. I mean, If you're into opiates, opiates do just like make you feel like everything is good and gonna be a-okay. And so it is one of those like universal, like a little bit of that feeling goes well with just about anything, I suppose. But ketamine is, I don't know. Ketamine's such an interesting, peculiar, I think it's because of the recreational stuff. Like when I do ketamine, it's to have a psychedelic experience. It's to like have a breakthrough and I'm like laying on a couch, incapacitated, disassociated, like in a K-hole. Whereas a lot of people are at a festival and just like wanting to do a little bump and dance around a little bit. And so I don't know, maybe an opiate might even be better suited for that. This is, you know, assuming nothing goes wrong, which is, a huge if with things like that. And right, because ketamine is like, you're losing your like coordination and stuff. Like, I don't know if you've had ketamine, but it can make you like, it gives you like a very like drunk body feeling kind of. And I mean, I'll get down and dance on ketamine here and there, but I don't know. I don't know what the appeal is there.
But I mean, it's one of those drugs where there definitely seem to be, or there are a lot of people touting its medical and therapeutic benefits, but that doesn't automatically mean that at all doses it's thumbs up, you know, great idea. It's possible something could be beneficial. It's not always true that if a little of something is good, a lot of it is great, you know.
I can say from someone who's done a ton of ketamine in the last, I don't know, how many, 5 years or something like that since I first started exploring it. I have, ketamine's the only psychedelic that I have like had zero personal growth from. Like it's the only one that I do kind of like willy nilly and it's like fun and I don't have to like mark my calendar. It's not like a big buildup, but I have had, like, I haven't learned a thing from I usually just feel dumb. I haven't had a single even good idea on ketamine, which is like psychedelics. Usually I do a mushroom trip and I spend the next 2 days like journaling with new ideas that I have.
Huh. Which, you know, I would probably say the same about like beer, you know. I don't have a notebook right full of like beer thoughts. Like, thank God for that breakthrough. I gotta circle back on this project I came up with.
Beer thoughts sounds like a tedious Instagram account that steals our jokes.
Yeah.
Like it just collates comedians' jokes and calls it beer thoughts, and just like, that's no, that's Stephen Wright, you asshole. That's not a beer thought. You just listen to, You just watched Comedy Central, wrote down 10 other people's jokes and put it on Instagram with a picture.
That's funny. I mean, that's the other thing too, is I also don't get ketamine as a social drug, but people are using it as that. I've done it as that, but it's not like but infrequently, and I don't like it that much. I don't know. I did once. I was at a festival. I was like, oh, I've never done ketamine at a festival before. And then I did a bunch of ketamine and I went to use the bathroom and I like got off track. I decided I didn't want to use the urinals and I just started like walking down this path. And there was this girl that I bumped into, that was like, Shane? And she had recognized me. She'd been at a festival that I threw. And I started talking to her slightly. I'm like basically in a K-hole. I had done too much. And then I had, and she's like trying to talk and I'm not saying much. And then I was like, a car was coming by. I'm like, can you hold on 1 second? I need to hold on to this tree for a second. And then I was like, oh, I did a bunch of ketamine. And she's like, oh, do you want to like lay down in this tent of mine? And that's how I got a girlfriend, at a festival. And that's the single best ketamine story in a social situation that I have. All of the other times that I've done ketamine in a social situation, I'm like, huh, this is awkward. And I don't think that girl would have found herself terribly attracted to me in that state had she not already seen me and like had a crush on me from a previous thing. So I don't get like alcohol.
It's not a first
I get
impression drug.
Yeah. Like alcohol, again, we're talking about like best case, like why you would hope something goes a certain way. Alcohol, sure. Like you get a little more loose. You can talk, you can dance or whatever. Ketamine is just like, it just makes you like weird and like hard. It makes moving it hard to do. I don't know.
I'd be interested to see like a sociologist or anthropologist down the line, go back and look at the eras of the last century and a half and comparing the popular recreational drugs of each era to the socio-political atmosphere of those times. You know, what is it about the current times? Because it does seem like ketamine is having a moment. And is this a symptom of bigger picture things going on in the world, you know, of just sort of like the collapse of institutions and no shared reality, no shared facts anymore, and you know, the depersonification of this current version of the internet. And yeah, is it, this is the right time for dissociatives where the 60s was the right time for LSD or something?
Yeah, it's also, I mean, it's also, you know, like we do like chasing trends and fads and stuff like that. It might be a little bit of that. It might be that like ketamine's been legitimized by people hearing about like ketamine clinical treatment, which actually does have like reliable, you know, therapeutic, value according to like the data, but that's a very, very different. You're having, not only are you having like therapy afterwards, but you're having therapy in between sessions, and ketamine's serving as like a little bit of a reset. But I think that it's, I mean, there's a zillion things. There's the loosening of everything with COVID, which I think the first bit of loosening happened because of 9/11. It's just like whenever things got, the war on drugs has been becoming like increasingly deprioritized, where just the average person is like, yeah, but I don't care about that. Like, I want to like have a job and pay less taxes and have there be like less serious crime and things like that. And so I don't know, like things that are, you know, suddenly 9/11 happens and they're no longer searching for drugs on a plane. They're searching for bombs. And then like COVID happened and everyone's just like, oh, we can just all do whatever else.
Right. No, yeah. I wonder if
opened
actually,
up like telehealth.
Yeah. This was the year that, I forgot if it was like Nicholas Christakis, somebody had an interesting theory of the timeline of what the next 4 years were going to be back in 2020, when asked, when are the Roaring Twenties going to happen? Because those were sort of a post-Spanish flu and post-World War One moment.
Yeah.
So, like, where are we going to have the Roaring Twenties? When would they start? And his hypothesis was, yes, but not until 2024. I remember hearing that in 2020 and being like, oh, God, no. Do we have that many years of shit ahead of us? And sure enough, we had that many years of shit ahead of us. And I wouldn't say we're in a roaring anything because we could still be either in the middle of or on the verge of a recession. And anyway. But speaking of therapy, we do actually have some stories for you. I don't know if you saw the link I just dropped in the show notes, but have you heard much about this new psychedelic toad?
Let's see.
5-MeO-DMT.
Oh, yes. 5-MeO. Is it? Yeah. I've done this. I mean, I thought this was new.
Okay.
This is new. I will say, so I can tell you, so in my current show, I do, I touch on cannabis only because it was like my gateway into psychedelics. So it's just like a part of my background to get us where we are, you know? And then, but I talk about, mushrooms, LSD, DMT, and ayahuasca. And I often have time to, if I have time, I'll talk about ketamine. The show's a little different each time, which is one of the, why I need a VJ, not like just have something that's like a PowerPoint presentation. It needs to be something that's like moving and flexible always. But anyway, and I'll sometimes sprinkle in some MDMA stuff. I just don't have a lot of MDMA material and it's like not really my thing. And it's like questionably not really that much of a psychedelic, but those things are things that people know. Like I would say that when I first did a show in like 2014, like, you really had to be in the know to know what ayahuasca was. I was fairly new to it myself. This is, you know, I'm talking like 10, 12 years ago or something. And then, and now kind of everyone lay people, knows what ayahuasca is.
And DMT and ayahuasca are sort of, like DMT is in ayahuasca, right?
Yeah, so DMT is the active ingredient. And so people are starting to know DMT. And so I would say it goes like everyone knows LSD and mushrooms. And then people kind of know maybe like ketamine and ayahuasca might be like neck and neck these days. Maybe ayahuasca a little bit more. And then DMT after those. And then after those, like if I was going to keep on milking this thing for everything it's worth and exploring more substances, I would say that of the things that I get asked about after a show when audiences, when people are like, hey, why don't, do you have any stories about this or whatever? I would say 5-MeO DMT is one of the bigger ones that's mentioned. And then,
so this
and
is
then
different
things,
from regular DMT. Like this is not the same
it
as
is.
DMT, but
the only thing similar about it. Well, I mean, I shouldn't say this, but I heard it described as like the only thing is like the letters DMT. That's the only thing that's like the same. I would say that it is like an out of body ish experience, in my, little experience, with it. But yeah, that's getting to be the new thing. 5-MeO. And then maybe I think 2CB might be like a contender. After that, but then there's like, so 2CB is a research, chemical. Alex Shulgin was this amazing chemist that essentially spent his life concocting a new psychedelic every week, and then trying it. And then when it went well, he would give it to his wife. And then when that went well, they would invite friends over and all do it. And then they would write, publication, and he had like a DEA license and everything. So he made well over 1,000 new psychedelics. 200 of them, about 200, almost 200 of them he enjoyed. And then and this is like each one of these is he's the first person ever having this experience. And then 2CB was 2CB and this other one 2CI were his those two were his and his wife's two favorites. And 2CB would be like The visuals of mushrooms with the kind of heart-opening body feel of MDMA, but like markedly clear-headed compared to most psychedelics, like very clear-headed and rational, not the same kind of like trippy thinking. And so that one might make waves after that, but yeah, 5-MeO, that is something that is like, I mean, people could certainly die. I would think that if like things went wrong or like have, you'd be at risk of having some pretty like bad experience. It's like very, very, very dose dependent. Like you'd really want to know what you're doing, to do it. And it's pretty intense, like major leagues to, it's potentially more intense than regular NMDMT, which is what most people are familiar with and is widely considered the most intense psychedelic experience on the planet. 5-MeO. So I first found out about it during my first tour. People would come up to me after a show and they'd be like, have you, and everyone would say the same thing. They'd go like, have you done, they'd hear me do a bunch of NMDMT material. And then they go like, have you had 5-MeO yet? And I'm like, no, I haven't. The timing hasn't been right or whatever. And they're like, oh, it's like the next level. Like every probably 100 people used those exact words in different cities and stuff. And like, I don't need more levels. Like DMT is so many levels.
Yeah, you've probably set this expectation now that like you're trying to always be like, no, maybe you just enjoy it and you don't want to get blasted off farther and farther every time.
Yeah, I also got to be careful because people will like give me psychedelic, but I'm like the psychedelic guy. So they're like, oh, he can handle whatever. So I'm like very careful about what I accept from people. People will like, try to like giving me mega doses, heroic doses and that sort of thing. And, so I'm relatively cautious. I don't accept anything from strangers usually.
Okay, so yeah,
be warned. An amazing story,
listeners. You don't have to bring gifts, but yeah, I wanted to get a little bit into this story from IFL Science about the 5-MeO-DMT because there's a new study that has shown efficacy as a treatment option for depression and anxiety, which I guess shouldn't be surprising because a lot of these similar substances have been found to have that. And I forgot if we mentioned that it's extracted from the venom of the Colorado River toad. And it's
which are kind of going extinct because of the newfound popularity of this stuff, actually.
Oh. I would have assumed that we had some way to synthesize them without having to squeeze.
I think we do, but it's, you know, the type of people that are after 5-MeO are the people that fall for like naturalistic fallacies and stuff. So it's like from the earth and whatnot. And so they are like happy to kill the earth to avoid something that came out of a lab.
One of my all-time favorite wellness fallacies. It's natural. Yeah, so is arsenic. So's tons of stuff that can very effectively. There's lava, for that matter.
Yeah, bears.
So, back on the 5-MeO-DMT, structural pharmacologist Daniel Wacker from the ICAN School of Medicine. It's ICAHN, not like a DIY medical school. Like anybody can medicine. ICAN School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, along with his colleagues, set out to investigate how 5-MeO-DMT interacts with a type of serotonin receptor called the 5-HT1A receptor. Most research on psychedelics up to now is focused on a similar but different receptor, 5-HT2A, because it's key to their ability to produce hallucinations. Previous research had shown that 5-HT1A was worth a closer look when it comes to developing new and improved antidepressants, but not much was known about how psychedelics interact with the receptor. To find out more, Wacker and the team modified the structure of the psychedelic compound at different sites, creating variants that could be tested for their potential efficacy. As well as examining the variants in vitro, they tested one in a mouse model of depression. They compared it to LSD as well as existing drugs that target 5-HT1A, and found that the toad venom compound had a similar antidepressant and anti-anxiety effect without getting the mice high. Okay, interesting. We showed that a 5-HT1A selective 5-MeO-DMT analog is devoid of the hallucinogenic-like effects, while retaining anxiolytic, I'm assuming that's anti-anxiety, like, and antidepressant-like activity in socially defeated animals. I've never heard the three words socially defeated animals. Nor do I know how you defeat animals socially. I just like roasting, maybe? Like, what's the...
Well, they have a, there's a, yeah. There's a zillion ways to cause depression and all sorts of things. One of my favorite for social depression is, well, it's in humans, but it can't be that hard to do something similar in social, other social mammals, which is, do you know that, that like ball tossing study?
No.
You go into a study and you're like sitting there in the waiting room and there's just like someone starts like someone has like a little football or something like that and they like start passing it between them and like another person and they like pass it to you too and now you're involved in this stupid little game of catch in the waiting room and you're all throwing the ball back and forth and but the other two people are confederates, they're actors who then start just throwing the ball back and forth to each other and excluding you completely. And it's a very, very reliable way to create social depression in a human being. In fact, they can do it just with computers and they can just have that's like a... the same like virtual game happening that does the same thing. But they believe
experiments
the other
as well.
Players
we've solved
to
how
real.
To make depression happen.
Well, if you want to figure out like what causes stressors and stuff like that, actually, one of the bigger things is having people. They have. I talked with someone on the Here We Are podcast that they did. They studied stress contagion between mother and infant, and so like how is stress transference. Happening. So first you want to take the baby away, make sure they're cool, and like having a good time, and then you take the mom and put them in a particular stressor, and what they've picked is having people give a talk about something they find really interesting in front of like five people or whatever, and those five people will just nod their head in not enjoying anything that you have to say. So they're just setting, you're just bombing for five straight minutes essentially, and then cortisol levels are dramatically increasing, and then they reunite baby with mother, and then baby's cortisol increases soon after, whether it's hormones or body language or whatever is soon to be known. But yeah, so socially stressing things. There's I'm sure there's things like that they do for animals.
So I'm trying to think of what this means for shitty comedians who have children when they come home from gigs.
Like your child just feels that you bombed.
Is daddy a hack? That's incredible.
Hey, you know who's not a hack?
Who's that?
Our amazing lineup that is filling out by the minute.
Yeah.
For to 29 and beyond. I think we should talk about this because it's fleshed out a little bit since we last spoke.
Very much so. Listeners have heard us talk about this, but June 7th and 8th, we've got two nights of stargazing, stand-up, and science in 29 Palms, and we have...
And podcasting. Let's not do down podcasting.
Oh, yeah. I guess the science was part of our podcasting. We already have announced some of our performers, including the legendary Bobcat Goldthwait, returning guest from NASA JPL, Dr. Farah Alibay. Of course, our podcast, Stargazing from Skywatcher Star Tours, courtesy of the great Caitlin Gill. But in 2 days, we're announcing some huge lineup additions. So we're going to have the individual passes for sale starting Friday, May 10th. But also, that's when the prices go up. So if you go to 229andbeyond.com right now, you can still get a discount weekend pass. And just trust me when I say... Just get it now because we're about to be dropping.
Because there's going
to
be a couple of other, let's say people who can draw a crowd, who people will go out of their way to watch performing on stage.
It's going to be very
fun. That sounds amazing.
much like Shane's show, yes, we will be, if not literally, then metaphorically blasting out to the stars from the desert.
So. Yeah, I won't be doing ayahuasca, but I am planning on taking something that will make me vomit and soil myself. So that's like, if you could recommend, well, we maybe go. Just some off food.
E. coli, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, there's actually speculation that the origins of ayahuasca, because people are like, how did they figure out that this bark and this root, when you combine them, like humans have just like never stumbled on combining two plants before or something. But some of the, like it doesn't take magic, but some of the speculation is that in jungles where you're, regularly encountering parasites and various like new bacteria and infections and things like that, that purging and the ability to purge is more like selected for, more important. And so what's the science word for things that make you purge? Purgatory?
Not expectorants.
Emetics?
Yeah.
Yeah, something like that. So they were like essentially trying to find out better and better ways to puke, and by combining different things, and then stumbled on ayahuasca. But there's also like the way that people test things in the jungle, some of these like shaman and stuff, is they'll like not like, I know people that have done this, that take this work like seriously, that they'll not eat or drink for like days, until you're like near death, and then you have just like a little bit of like a fern or like just like a little bit of a leaf of some new plant or whatever, and because it's the first thing that's entered your body in like 5 days or whatever, it's like you can feel it in like every cell of your being and kind of feel what it's doing that much more intensely, and that's how you can feel like the nuance of a novel plant. And so if you're doing that and then chewing on some bark that has a bunch of DMT in it, perhaps they stumbled on something that way.
Wait, so again, the theory is that things that made you throw up are correlated. Can you summarize that?
So if you're in the jungle, there's going to be like more situations in which it's beneficial to throw up, to like rid yourself of like toxins or whatever.
Oh,
like
not to prepare for. Okay. As a way to save you from those things that are toxic, not as a way to clear out your system so you get.
Those are two different ways that ayahuasca could have been stumbled upon, that I think that the way that I said it maybe conflated the two together, but those were two separate thoughts.
This kind of links interestingly to an article Justin Broad sent in from the BBC about wounded orangutan seen using a plant as medicine. Which I think is pretty cool. A Sumatran orangutan in Indonesia has self-medicated using a paste made from plants to heal a large wound on his cheek. It's the first time a creature in the wild has been recorded treating an injury with a medicinal plant. After researchers saw Rakus, that's the name of the orangutan, I presume, applying the plant poultice to his face, the wound closed up and healed in a month. Is a month good for a healing? Like, I would like to know how long it takes this wound to heal without plant interference, because that feels like quite a long time, but I don't know. The scientists say the behavior could come from a common ancestor shared by humans and great apes. Biologist Dr. Isabella Lauma at the Max Planck Institute said they are our closest relatives, and again, this points towards the similarities that we share with them. We're more similar than we are different. So this research team in the Gunung Laisa National Park in Indonesia spotted Rakus with a large wound on his cheek. They believed he was injured fighting with rival males because he made loud cries called long calls in the days before they saw the wound. And the team then saw him chewing the stem and leaves of a plant called akar kuning, an anti-inflammatory and antibacterial plant that is also used locally to treat malaria and diabetes. I presume by humans, not by orangutans in this situation. But he repeatedly applied the liquid onto his cheek for 7 minutes and then smeared the chewed leaves onto his wound until it was fully covered. He continued to feed on the plant for over 30 minutes. And they, apparently, within 5 days, there was no sign of infection and the wound closed. And after a month, he was fully healed.
That's amazing.
Apparently the researchers think that he knew he was applying medicine because the orangutans rarely eat this particular plant and because of the length of the treatment. He repeatedly applied the paste, says Dr. Lauma, and he later also applied more solid plant matter. The entire process lasted a really considerable amount of time. That's why we think he intentionally applied it. And the researchers also saw Raku's resting for much longer than usual, more than half of the day, suggesting he was trying to recuperate. There's been other cases of discovery of apes using medicine to heal themselves, great apes.
Yeah.
Jane Goodall in the 60s saw whole leaves in the feces of chimpanzees. Others documented seeing great apes swallowing leaves with medicinal properties, but they've never seen a wild animal applying a plant directly to a wound.
It says here this ape just signed a 7-figure licensing deal with goop.com.
Yeah.
Good for you, buddy.
I'll smell his candles.
Yeah.
So here's what they think might have happened. Dr. Lauma says it's possible that this is the first time Raccoon has done this type of treatment. She says it could be that he accidentally touched his wound with his finger that had the plant on it. And because the plant has quite potent pain-relieving substances, he might have felt immediate pain relief, which would have made him apply it again and again. Or he could have learned the methods from watching other orangutans. And so they're now going to be closely watching all of the animals to see if they can spot the same medical skills that Raku's showed.
That's fascinating. There is like different spice use in different parts of the world. Mostly like you can predict the amount of spice use by humans by how close they are to the equator, because the more the better climate is for bacteria and parasites and such, the more need there is for like antimicrobial type things that like spices often have. And so they made this prediction and then went around the world testing it. But it's like specific to, there'll be like regions where, I can't think of like a good example, but there'll be like a specific disease that like cinnamon in particular or whatever will be good for helping, and that region just tends to on average go through more of that particular spice as measured by the like amount used on average per year per person in that area. So there's also ways that these things just get stumbled on over time and then kind of slightly selected for.
Does that sort of explain why the closer you get to either pole, the blander the native food gets? Or is that just, yeah, fewer things grow in general where it's cold? Or,
well, from that lens, that would be the explanation for it. Yeah, I'm from Wisconsin. I love bland food. People make fun of me for, I eat just plain rice cakes. Like,
oh my God,
not salted, nothing. I know, I get that reaction a lot. Plain rice cakes, I'll just chomp on them. It's a lovely snack. Kind of want one right now, actually. But yeah, it's a lot of just bland, just like meat, just a lot of throw like a brisket in a crock pot with some carrots and potatoes and like a little bit of broth and there you go. So that's the kind of bland northern.
It sounds pretty
food.
Sounds pretty tasty, actually. But yeah, I get what you mean. You're not doing it tons is. Of. Yeah, I mean, you can't really fuck up a brisket, can you?
No, but people in the north don't necessarily like spicy food.
Right, right.
Whereas a lot of people near the equator can't get enough of the stuff. Obviously, like the south and Mexico and India and those regions, but what's interesting about that to me is that there's specific regions that have like very specific spices that have been shown to like be good for a specific thing for reasons I don't know about, but
interesting, yeah.
But yeah, it's just give it enough time and people stumble on a useful pattern, which is I actually thought of this earlier because you were talking about how fast things are changing with the different trends, and with our modern world with internet and having access to all these novel ideas and things that we can try and everything, we certainly aren't going through like many generations of like trial and error to stumble on if like ketamine is a good thing for dancing or not, so evolution's just happening weirder and faster in our world. Like telehealth, for example, made it easy to get ketamine lozenges. I don't know if you've ever done a ketamine lozenge, which is now like a popular thing on the streets just because you can get access to it more readily. And it's like, ooh, a lozenge. I want that. I've done multiple ketamine lozenges with the exact same effect every time. It just feels like coming down from ketamine, which is like not the best. It's like kind of the worst parts of being drunk. And then also just really intense gas. So it's just, that's the experience.
That's the pharmaceutical.
Like wildly what's the appeal popular. Of this?
Yeah.
It's that people are just like, ooh, this is what ketamine is. And you know, it's just like, and a lot of times because of like, you know, social effects, placebo effects, everything else, just to feel different is something, you know, that's like enjoyable for the right personality or whatever.
Right.
But yeah, it's for someone that's had like proper ketamine experiences, I would say it falls very short of regular ketamine, but it just happens to be trendy just because of access, because of like, you know, the people not having like very clear specific information about like how different how ketamine can be ingested and done in different ways, and just that it's like a huge fad right now.
Yeah. I also wonder,
I think drugs are fascinating.
Agreed. I was also wondering if you've heard much about, I just heard someone talking about Ozempic and how there's a theory that part of what it's doing as an appetite suppressant might also be suppressing other drives that we might not want suppressed. Like, you know, it might also make you less ambitious, you know, like there might be some cost to turning down some of these internal knobs, beyond the, it's like, yeah, there's no free lunch for anything. And all these things that are new, yeah. It's like, well, how long until we know what else, you know, what else we're inducing with this fix, you know?
And that makes all sorts of sense. I know when my appetite can be fickle generally as a person that just naturally has like a very small stomach and has always been like very skinny. But I do find like when I'm down, like when my appetite for life tends to be down generally, so is my usual appetite. So
yeah.
Maybe it could go the other way around.
That's interesting. Well, should we wrap up the main episode and do a little bonus for our Patreon subscribers?
I think we should.
Do you have a minute to stick around with us, Shane?
Yeah, I could share my 5-MAO DMT story or something like that in the Patreon episode if you want.
Ooh, I like that idea. You could go to patreon.com/probablyscience if you want to help support the podcast and get some bonus content, including Shane's upcoming 5-MEO DMT story, which we'll throw in today's bonus. But regular listeners, thank you. Oh, by the way, a quick note about last week's episode with Sierra Cato. I was listening back and I'd already uploaded it, and then I realized that there was some drift in her audio, which sometimes happens just because of differing internet speeds. And it sounded like we were being real dicks and stepping over her a lot more than we were. Just trust that we were not trying to cut her off, but that the internet connection caused a time differential that made it sometimes seem like we were responding to things before she even said them. So we didn't develop that premonition skill last week. It was just an accident of technology.
Oh, I was trying to guess what she was going to say constantly. That's how I deal.
Shane, where can our listeners keep up with you and find out info on the tour?
Yeah, Shane Moss. It's MAUSS.com, where hopefully in the following days I'm going to have the nicest, newest, fanciest site ever. But I have... So this isn't like... We need to... this information will be on the new page, but the old page doesn't really talk about how big this tour is. We're on show 107 or something like that, and we're doing 222 shows. And so we are constantly adding more dates. And so join my email list to check that out. And maybe I'll bring my podcast back from hiatus, but I'm working on a docuseries project at the moment. So keep up with me.
Excellent. Yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing the May 28th one in Palm Springs.
Awesome.
And listeners, probablyscience@gmail.com for any questions, comments, clarifications, stories you'd like us to cover. You can find us on Twitter @probablyscience, individually @AndyTWood, @JesseCase. Hope you're okay over there, Jesse, and @MattKirshen. And you can go to probablyscience.com for all of the links to the stories we cover, plus our Patreon link. Thank you everyone who helps to support the show that way. And also a link directly to 229 and beyond. Or you can cut out the middleman on that one and go to 229andbeyond.com. Get your tickets now. Like Andy says, we're about to be announcing more people, but the price is going to go up. So you can get in under the wire. Be an OG. Get in there. And it's going to be awesome. I can just tell you right now, it's going to be a very, very cool weekend.
Excellent. And we will see you next time.
Bye.